From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how two area colleges are aiming to alleviate the nursing shortage in Wisconsin.
Later, UWM architecture students work on a design for a solar home and think about how it would affect its inhabitants.
I like the idea of having a very great impact on, like, one family. And as people, as friends of theirs and family come to visit, they'll also see and, like, kind of spread the word.
We'll have the most important thing actor Scott Greer learned in performing an audience interactive one-person play.
No matter what people give you, it is an act of generosity on their part, and that it is my job to accept that generosity in whatever form it takes.
And Radio Chipstone delves into tramp art. Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is a cliche to talk about the length of time we spend waiting to be seen by a doctor. On one hand, we like the idea practitioners might spend enough time with patients to get a thorough understanding of what's ailing us, but we also have better things to do with our lives than sitting in a waiting room.
One issue that might be playing into that dynamic, though, is the mounting shortage of nurses. It's a problem that's been building for some time, and nursing schools have been searching for ways to graduate enough newly degreed nurses to keep up with the demand.
In the Milwaukee area, that's meant a growing number of institutions have been teaming up to get nurses into the workforce quickly while still enabling them to pursue higher nursing degrees. Michelle Nelson is Associate Dean of Nursing at Waukesha County Technical College, one of two schools partnering with Mount Mary University on a so-called 1-2-1 program, which allows students to first earn an associate, then a bachelor's degree in nursing. Kara Groom is Chief Nurse Administrator and Department Chair at Mount Mary. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us this morning.
Yes, thank you, Mitch.
So I went back and looked through my interview notes, and I think I did my first interview on the looming nursing shortage about a decade ago. And I'm sure it has been on the radar of people in the healthcare industry for even longer than that. Given how long we've known that it's an issue, how have things changed in recent years, either in terms of getting better or worse or just understanding it differently?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that registered nurses are the largest single occupation in healthcare. And so when we talk about the shortage of nursing, it's really pressing for everyday patient care. But yes, we had some projections early on that really spoke to this impending shortage in nursing. And when we entered sort of the recession, we found that that impending shortage didn't hit us in quite the way we had forecasted. But now, again, our models are showing that we are really facing a crisis in nursing as far as the need for nurses in our clinical settings, retiring nurses, and a shortage of nurses in the pipeline.
So what happened during the recession? Did people put off retirement? I mean, was it just the difficult financial times that made people want to stay in the field longer?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of factors. But yes, I think that for some families, they might have delayed retirement. Or for a nurse who might have been working part-time during that recession period, they might have opted for full-time or picking up some overtime hours. So that what we had anticipated to see didn't really hit us quite as hard as we had forecasted.
You know, it wasn't that people suddenly got healthier and then the demand went down.
That would have been a really fortunate, but no, that wasn't really the case.
And so we were talking about how this demand has built up. We're also talking about, you know, changing demographics both among nurses and among the patient population, right?
Yeah. So it's a matter of our nursing workforce aging and hitting an imminent retirement, as well as our patient population. So our baby boomers are at a stage where we're needing and have an increased need for healthcare demand. And so it's kind of this, it hits us on both the demand for nursing professionals as well as the amount of patients that we're seeing in a clinical setting.
And I imagine also nursing educators as well, because nursing educators have been probably in the field for the longest.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because not only do we need nurses to care for the baby boomers, but also we need qualified educators. And I want to go back to you had mentioned earlier regarding the survey, and it's a collaborative effort between the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development and Wisconsin Center for Nursing. So we have this great data from surveys where nurses and LPNs are mandated to take the survey, and that's where we collect all our data from. And from that, we know that 46% of our nurses are currently 55 years or older. And it's projected that we will have 59% of these educators tend to leave their current position in the next 9 years. So we definitely need the advanced practice nurses and those nurses who continue to get their master's and doctorate.
I was just going to say, we at some point might need to do an interview about the need for master's and doctoral level nurses as well.
Right.
So let's talk then about how this one-to-one program speaks to the issue. You know, how does it speak to the nursing shortage and maybe to the overall changes in the nursing profession?
Well, we were tasked with the Institute of Medicine's report in 2010 that really spoke to the need to increase seamless academic progression for nursing students to be able to really address that impending shortage. And so the Nursing One-to-One program is really designed to make that progression seamless for students. So they would be a Mount Mary student for all 4 years. They would take their first year of general ed and science coursework, and then they would choose Waukesha County Technical College or another Wisconsin Technical College partner to do their clinical training. But the beauty of the program then is after year three, they're workforce ready. So they're working as a nurse sooner, yet still on track for that bachelor's degree completion in 4 years.
Well, so talk about the level of coordination. What goes on between the departments at the two schools, in this case, Mount Mary and WCTC? But as you say, there are other technical college partners that Mount Mary has and other, I think, other schools around the state. What are the challenges in making this operate smoothly?
I think our agreement that we had with Mount Mary, we had a number of conversations and meetings of people coming together, and that included anywhere from marketing to financial aid, our learning VPs, the nursing administrators, and it takes a village to create this, right? So we met a number of times, and as you said, we also have partnerships or agreements with other colleges such as UW-Milwaukee. We have students that are sitting and waiting to get into the program, and it's really nice that we have these agreements that students have options to go elsewhere.
Yeah, I would really add that the goal in all of those conversations was to make it as seamless for the student as possible so that we would put in the work on the back end and behind the scenes in these meetings and conversations so that the student experience is one of seamless progression.
Well, and so the idea is eventually to graduate bachelor's degree nurses, BSNs, in 4 years. So why is the nursing associate's degree an important part of the picture as well?
Mm-hmm. So we graduate, in Wisconsin, we graduate approximately 3,000 nurses a year, right? And I don't have those statistics in front of me, but we are a feeder to those BSN programs. There's many students that have life outside of school where they need to work or take care of their loved ones and make it affordable. So it's very cost effective for students to be able to go part-time. We do offer a part-time track and receive their associate degree in nursing. And then once they are able to, that they can move on and achieve their BSN. We talk about lifelong learning and constantly address that with our students. And I think it's very exciting that we have this opportunity for our students to complete their bachelor's degree.
Let me ask a really maybe basic question for those of you in the field, but one that I think probably a lot of people have. You know, most of us are probably aware there are different degrees within nursing. Can you talk about what nurses with BSNs bring to caring to patients versus people with other credentials like associate degree nurses?
Yeah, when we look at kind of the needs and trends in our healthcare environments and for the future of nursing, I think we have a real need to prepare nurse leaders and to help them be ready for implementing evidence-based practice, to take on roles in nursing informatics, nurse educator positions. And we're hearing from our clinical partners that what the bachelor's degree nurses bring to the table is that they're ready for career advancement opportunities as well. And so they bring a level of evidence-based practice foundation and are really ready to enter into some advanced roles in their career.
And upon graduation, they come out at the same point where they can work in the clinical setting and make the same salary between a 4-year and a 2-year graduate. So that's exciting. And as Kara said, yes, we want our nurses to advance and continue to not only complete their bachelor's, but go on and receive their master's or a doctoral prepared nurse to be able to be an educator, because not only do we have a shortage in nursing, but also, you know, CNAs and having qualified educators. We don't have enough of that. So that's important, too.
Well, and I gather that the healthcare providers out there are looking for more people with a more versatile background. And so therein lies the whole tuition reimbursement that many offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our healthcare employers are really telling us that they have a need for nurses in general and are really incentivizing and encouraging that bachelor's prepared nurse, and whether that's at the entry point to the career or whether that's a nurse who goes back to complete an RN to BSN program. I think our clinical partners are really emphasizing and looking for that bachelor's preparation.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the entry point, because I think it's the Wisconsin Center for Nursing that reported the state needs to graduate an additional 7,500 nurses a year by 2020, which is a lot of nurses considering, as you were saying, we graduate something on the order of 32 or 3,300 a year now. This is to keep up with demand. What has to happen on the front end to encourage more people to go into nursing?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. We recently had the Waukesha County Business Alliance. This is just one example where they had approximately 500 middle school and high school children come through this healthcare career expo, learn about not only nursing, but also all healthcare careers. We know that there's also a shortage in medical assistants and certified nursing assistants. So I think the quicker that we can reach the individuals, now I said middle school, and that sounds so young, but to get their interest early. That's one thing at Waukesha County Technical College. We have a Discover Me camp, and it's offered in the summer. And I highly recommend that people take a look at that and encourage them to register. So that's for middle school and high school. And that's to look at different programs and to catch them while they're young and get interest.
Yeah, and similarly, we do a lot of real active partners with high schools. You know, a need and a trend we haven't spoke to yet is really the need to increase diversity in our mm-hmm. nursing workforce. And one of the things that I think Mount Mary University's program really brings as a strength is that we are a majority minority institution. And so, and our nursing student body mimics the diversity of the general Mount Mary population. And so we're reaching out and building partnerships to really recruit diverse students into Mount Mary and into the nursing profession early.
Well, so let me ask a delicate question, maybe. Where does job satisfaction fit in this picture? Is it difficult to convince people they want to go into a profession where there's a shortage of colleagues? You know, is workload or burnout an issue that you have to guard against?
Right. And we try to be transparent with our students, right, and let them know, yes, you need this healthy work-life balance. And how do you get that? I think our partners, how they offer innovative-type scheduling, whether it's you work 3 12-hour shifts a week and then you're off for maybe a weekend shifts only, 7 days on, 7 days off, 10-hour shifts. So I think they need to continue to be creative with their scheduling and emphasize that it needs to be have a healthy work-life balance.
Yeah, and I think we're recognizing in professions such as nursing that there is some real caregiver burnout that people can experience. And so more and more we're seeing a real emphasis on care for the caregiver so that we really build a model of reflective practice that helps recognize the impactful moments that a nurse experiences and how we can build the resilience for nurses to stay excited, passionate, and empathetic for a lifetime.
Yeah, it does nobody any good to graduate an enthusiastic nurse who 2 years down the road thinks, oh, my God, I'm overworked and, you know, it's a thankless task. And why didn't I go into something else?
Yeah, and I think the beauty of clinical training is that the students, we do lots of lab and simulation types of experiences, but the clinical training model of nursing is one where they're out taking care of patients for really the duration of their educational experience. And so we can build in our nursing education those reflective moments and model kind of the techniques Michelle talked about taking care of yourself to be able to take care of others, and they experience that as a student and then can build those practices for the future.
Do most people who graduate with a nursing degree stay in the profession for And maybe this is something you don't know, so I don't have to ask it. But I was just curious, you know, what the average length of a nursing career is.
You know, I really don't have the specific answer, but I think what's exciting with nursing is you envision yourself, oh, yeah, I want to work at this hospital, and you do it. But knowing that there are so many other opportunities, and that's what's so exciting, that nurses can work in an industrial setting. They can be an educator, school nurse, long-term, you know, nursing home type care, acute care. So I guess I speak to the students, too, and let them know that there's so many different opportunities, and that's what makes it exciting. So would that keep somebody in the field longer? Possibly.
Well, and presumably the two of you each learned that lesson at some point in your careers, as you both have nursing degrees. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, my personal path was one of working every shift, including weekend nights, during a time that enabled me to be home with young children, as well as going back to school and pursuing my master's degree and then eventually my PhD. And so with the demand, I think the encouraging thing for nursing students is there are jobs and there is a nursing need for them to fill, no matter how part-time or full-time they want to work and no matter what clinical setting they find that's going to really be right for them.
Are there things that each of you miss about patient care?
Definitely. That was the number one difficult thing to give up. And when I moved and transitioned from industrial, you know, working as a nurse, and then into the education, academia world, I thought I would have to give it up. But I really didn't because I had clinical with my students, so those patients became my patients. But now in an administration type role, I would say that's the number one thing that I miss.
Yeah, I would concur. I loved my time as a clinical instructor where I got to do both. I got to supervise, enroll, and mentor nursing students, yet still be at the bedside caring for patients. And I still get to do that now on my clinical visits with our capstone students who are finishing up their final semester of their nursing leadership and nursing capstone courses. And so you still have those ties, but it can be an absolute part you miss.
Mm-hmm. You're not hoping for like broken bones around the office, though.
Not yet.
No.
Well, listen, Kara Groom and Michelle Nelson, thank you both so much, and best of luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us today.
Kara Groom is Chief Nurse Administrator and Nursing Department Chair at Mount Mary University. Michelle Nelson is Associate Dean of Nursing at Waukesha County Technical College. There is a link to more about the 121 program at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we'll meet two UW-Milwaukee architecture students already on the cutting edge of their field. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Five UWM architecture students have earned national attention. They're part of a combined team made up of students in UWM's School of Architecture and Urban Planning and UW-Madison engineering students.
Their energy-efficient home design called Domus Solis, which is Latin for solar home, will be vying with the buildings designed by teams from around the globe in the U.S. Department of Energy's Solar Decathlon.
The contest takes place at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado this weekend. Earlier this week, Lake Effect's Susan Bentz met with two of the UWM members of the team.
Max Rodensel and Chris Clawitter are juniors majoring in architecture. Chris says this project is unlike any other they've taken on thus far in their college years.
In studio, we do a lot of conceptual projects, so just projects that, like, you do some form finding and program diagramming and stuff, and then submit it, like, 6 weeks later and call it a day. This has been going on since October, and we've worked with engineers and done construction drawings, and this is like the one project that we could actually build in real life, and we haven't ever done that before. So I'd say this is the most complex project we've done.
Yeah, like Chris said, just the scale and what it really means. It's not just, you have this arbitrary site where you're designing something for. It's in Madison, so like we've been to the site, we've seen like what it feels like, and like we're just developing it, and we're actually like competing to get it built, really.
Cool. So when you say it's in Madison, it will be built in Madison?
The site that we chose is in Madison, and then if we win, then we go into the build competition. But I think there's plans to in the future to do some connections with other schools.
So where in Madison? On campus somewhere?
No, it's on the west of Lake Monona.
Okay. So. Now, another nuance of this is the other part of your team, the engineering part, is our students in, at UW.
Yeah.
So have you mostly just communicated by Skype?
So, yeah, we Skype every Monday for like half an hour, but we have met them twice, right?
Yeah, we met them. Well, we met them in Milwaukee once, and then we met in Madison once, just like have a more in-person meeting. But for the most part, it's been all through like digital means.
You guys have come up with the design, and they've added the engineering, meaning how can you make this most efficient in solar, the maximum solar capacity?
Yeah, so I think when we got pitched this project by a professor, he said we're in charge of making it look good and they're in charge of making it work. And we've really stuck by that. So we've developed a house that we could actually market, and it's not just like a conceptual project that just looks weird and nobody else would get it. So it looks like a real house. And then the engineers made the solar panels work, the heating work, the air conditioning, the plumbing. They did all of that stuff.
So give me an idea of the basic. Is it ultra-modern looking? Is it lots of windows, not many windows?
Commonly, the competition gets like all these students from different universities, and they all really want to design things similar to their studio projects, so it can be kind of over the top. But we kind of went for the approach of very marketable for like the general public, because that's who is really going to be buying it. So we need to go and see what makes their house now special and what makes them driven to like live in their house. The idea of moving from a normal house where they live in now to a net zero home, it might be frightening. So in order to like encourage people to do so, we need to like still make sure it feels like the house they live in now, where they just have to make slight changes to their lifestyle.
Why could there be anxiety about moving into a net zero home? Just the hearing that term, yeah, and not it being an unknown?
And we visited a net zero home in Milwaukee, and the lifestyle changed a little bit. They have to always like have windows closed and doors closed, and they have to like be really strict on how they are exposed to the outdoors and then adjusting things. Also, the lady was telling us that like sometimes she just has to be a little uncomfortable with the temperature or like the thermostat or whatever, because that's just the way it worked. And so I think that's the biggest adjustment for people. Like in regards to look though, we wanted it to feel like a normal house. Like you weren't even knowing that it was off the grid, but it was.
Can you give a few hints? Is it a single story? Is it?
Well, we're in that urban single family competition guideline. And so our lot is pretty close to its neighbors. So, and it's on the corner, but we didn't want to create a very large home on the corner. We wanted to keep it minimal, so it appears like a single-story house, but we actually have bedrooms packed into the attic space just to maximize.
Do people have to crawl up there?
No.
So like, yeah. It feels like it's like the gable of the attic, but it's not actually like an attic, if you like. It's finished.
Yeah.
And
sure.
It's like a unique way of putting it without making it two stories.
So not to get too engineery, but are there challenges with that when you have sleeping space right up in terms of ventilation and temperature?
Well, obviously, like hot air rises, so that could be a problem. I think that we've designed it pretty well in terms of that. We have a double height space over the kitchen and the main dining area, where as hot air or hot like the sun comes into the space, it's obviously going to heat that air up. So we allowed it to like naturally ventilate to the top of the gable on the inside, and then the living upstairs is just packed in there.
So how many square feet, I should ask that?
Yeah, so it's the competition guidelines for the urban single family are you have to be below 2,500, and we squeezed right in there.
Yeah. I think our final is 2,498 square feet.
Yeah. Wow, nice job. Yeah, so how has this project influenced your, you know, what you're thinking about your future career?
Well, I've really been interested in sustainability. I've been taking classes outside of architecture on it, and I want to go to college for commercial sustainability, and I've treated this as like a stepping stone. So I've gotten my feet wet with a house that's sustainable. So like the next mission is like do an office building that's sustainable or apartment building. And that slowly gets up to like a skyscraper that's completely sustainable, because that's kind of what the future of architecture is going toward. Massive amounts of population in cities, but buildings that are destroying the the planet. So how to work with both of them.
Personally, I'm interested in like the science behind what makes a space nice, or what is intriguing people. So whether it's like kind of getting my feet wet in like neuroscience within architecture right now. Sounds like a lot, but like it's kind of, I'm making my way into it. Yeah. And then between that and then like thermal comfort, I find really intriguing. So those two inside a single family home I've kind of been able to like, okay, like how can I think about these issues or like elements when designing for a family, instead of having a studio project, like classwork where they're just telling you exactly what you need. It's like, okay, I have some freedom to like figure out what I find important in this space. So.
Cool. So what was toughest about this? Working on this
project? I would say the collaboration, because we were in two separate like cities, and the engineers think one way and we think a different way, and those thought processes don't always collide correctly. And I think just working in a team, we haven't really been exposed to that yet. We've done individual projects throughout our whole architectural careers in school, and so now we finally got in the team, which is real life, and it was a little harder to transition than we thought.
What great experience early on, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Of course, because out in the real world, there's no individual projects unless you're a one-man firm. But even then, you're working with engineers all the time.
What would you say on that topic?
I'd say you hit it pretty well, but yeah, definitely, like, it's like, oh, wow, people aren't just going to be okay with your design. They're like, if the engineers are like, oh, I don't like this, or, like, this isn't working, I'm like, oh, okay, like, all right, time to figure it out then. Yeah, it's definitely been a different experience.
What's your schedule when you get to Golden, Colorado?
Friday night, everyone creates a poster and like has it on display, and there's hors d'oeuvres. The judges and other students can kind of get a feel for like what the competition is like. And then everyone on Saturday presents. And then I think the top three or five from all groups represent Sunday morning.
Wow.
And then they get told who like the grand winners are. And there's also like connection workshops where there's a bunch of people from leading companies in the energy field, and so that'll be really useful.
Well, how many teams are you competing against?
In our category, mm-hmm. there are originally 18. Wow. And you needed to be the top eight. So there's eight groups now in the finals.
Could you have selected any of the building types to compete in?
Yeah.
So how did you decide on this?
Well, obviously it's a smaller project. We kind of decided lets you put more into it and develop it more. If we were to develop or design an apartment complex, it might be more efficient because you're getting more people under the same outer membrane of the building. So the engineers might be like, oh, well, my building performs better. But in reality, the spaces might not be as developed. Or I like the idea of having a very great impact on like one family. And as people, as friends of theirs and family come to visit, they'll also see and like kind of spread the word.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we didn't treat this as a competition. We wanted to build a house that not just like works for this one site in Madison. We wanted to build this house that could be used all around the nation at different sites. We designed a home. We didn't design a competition home, you know.
So last question. Is there an element of the design that you're like best or are proudest of, or is it the whole combination?
I think what I'm proudest of, like how we turned a house that was supposed to be an off the grid into a home that just looks like a home. So like we've created spaces where like social interactions could happen due to like a taller ceiling. We've kept the open floor plan, tied appliances down to one plumbing wall to reduce pipe traveling. There's just a lot of features that we definitely thought a lot about, and so it's I'm proud of.
In terms of what is like needed in Wisconsin, all commercial buildings need a vestibule. you need it for coating because of like not allowing the cold in and like so it stays like a nice temperature on the inside. And we kind of brought that into our home. So we have vestibules for the house that double as like a mud room. It's like vacuum shut. So I think that was really special. I hope the judges like it. We also have a like our dining nook has a table and then like a nook of seating, like a bench along the wall. So like right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then
where it bumps out.
Yeah. So when the space isn't being used, you just push the table over the seating. So then it takes up less space in the kitchen. But then say you have like your family over or like you have like friends over, then you just pull the table back out and people can like occupy all that seating in there. It's
very
all about
cool.
using the space to the best because you are really paying for every single square foot. So you got to make sure you're not heating space that you're not using to the
sure,
best. So
that space,
I think that was really creative. So.
UWM architecture students Chris Klawitter and Max Rudensel are part of a team competing this weekend at the U.S. Department of Energy Solar Decathlon. The team includes UWM architecture students and students from UW-Madison's engineering department.
They hope to build a prototype of their nearly 2,500-square-foot home near downtown Madison next year in preparation for the Solar Decathlon Build Challenge in Washington, D.C.
Another break now, and then we'll meet the performer in a powerful new production at the Milwaukee Rep. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On the page, every brilliant thing is a one-man show. However, in reality, the audience each night plays a crucial role in how the show unfolds. Audience participation is mandatory, although as its star, Scott Greer, reassures us, you can say no just as long as someone says yes.
The play, which previews tonight at the Milwaukee Rep, is a very simple story of a man and his mother and the relationship they have from the time he was a child through his adulthood. It's poignant, powerful, and funny, even though it deals with difficult subjects like depression. Scott Greer joins us in the studio now. Scott, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is kind of a scary proposition, this play. I read it in preparation for this interview, and I thought, wow, this is so difficult because there's so much audience participation. It's not just suggested, it's required.
Yeah, right. There are five characters in the play that I cast every night from the audience. And it's important to me that it is not a sort of gotcha audience participation. I greet people as they come in. The larger sort of mechanism of participation is I hand out these numbered cards, about 60 of them. And when I call out the number, they read what is on the card and aloud. And but this sort of allows you to get to know people a little bit and test their comfort level. And many people say, no, thank you. And that is completely fine with me and preferable, in fact, because I want people to have a good time and not feel nervous or like annoyed. And the vast majority of people are happy to help out and participate. But I don't want to feel like they have to, you know. So the ones that I pick are generally really, really game, and it's a great experience for everybody.
What's interesting to me is people talk in theater about every show is different every night.
Yes.
This is even more true.
That is correct. Other than me, everything is completely different.
Right, yeah. And maybe the lighting cues. But, you know, you have, you are going into it knowing your script, but also not knowing your script, depending on what reactions you get that night and who says, yes, I will participate.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Is that terrifying in a particular way, or is it invigorating?
It's exhilarating. It's really, I could do this play forever because it never gets boring. It's different every single night, and I love it. I love that sort of improvisational element of it, and people's incredible sort of presence and generosity, and the opportunity to create a little community every night and people have ownership of the show. They're part of the show. The lights never fully go down, so the audience is in the round, and they can see each other, and it really is this this little community that we form every night. It's really
a community around a very difficult subject.
For sure.
Which is suicide.
That's correct.
And
suicide and depression, yeah.
Right. How did you first get introduced to this play?
The director, Terry Nolan, who's the artistic director of the Arden Theater Company in Philadelphia, was turned on to it a few years ago he was at the Edinburgh Festival and while it was playing, and he didn't see it, but someone said, oh, you really need to check this out. So he did. He and I have known each other for a long time and done many shows together and have a close collegial relationship. And so he, you know, thought that this would be great for us to do together, and he was right.
And you've been working on it now for how many years? A couple
we
years?
We did it for the first time in the fall of 2017, November and December, and then we brought it back this past November and December. So this is the third time that I'm doing it.
What have you learned from those first two times that you're bringing to the Milwaukee Rep version?
The most important thing is that no matter what people give you, it is an act of generosity on their part, and that it is my job to accept that generosity in whatever form it takes. You know, early on when I was doing it, you have to learn to let go of like, okay, I want it to be this way. I want it, you know, like, yes, thank you, do this for me, but do it the way I want, you know, and you have to let go of that. And once I learned to really let go of that, the show was better for me and for the audience.
And probably truer to the original writers of it, too, because you read in the script, which, of course, the audience isn't going to see, but you read the instructions
right
to the actor, to the narrator who you are, even
that's
though
right.
that's you're never called that. And so there's a lot of, if this happens, go this way. If this happens, go this way.
Yes.
And giving you the freedom to create that.
Yes, the published script has a number of footnotes that kind of indicate what you're talking about. Of like, so Johnny, who's the original performer, often this would happen, and here's one or two things that he would say. You know, you might want to say something like that. And it was a very helpful guide. And there are definitely sort of quote unquote scripted ad libs that you know, comments that get a laugh that I say, you know, every night. But it's, you know, what another human being coming in that you've never met is going to do is always a wild card. And so the challenge is to just sort of be present and with them and let them do what they're going to do, you know?
Have you found that doing this show has made you more present in your own life? Because you have to be so open to whatever is thrown at you in the course of the evening?
What a great question. I hope so. I like to think so. I know that as a performer, it certainly has. It's been just a really great sort of education for my skill and for my soul, I think. So improvisation is something that I've done for a long time, and it taught me, I think, the most of all of my experiences in, you know, in school and all of that. I think I learned the most about being an actor through improvisation, exactly what you're talking about, being present, really listening, and kind of, you know, trusting your instincts. One of those things was comedy sports, which, started here in Milwaukee. I was in the Philadelphia franchise for about 8 years. And my friend, who was then the artistic director, used to have the ritual after the show. We would high-five people as they left, you know. It's a sort of sports trope, you know, and kind of like as the audience is leaving, we would all line up outside and high-five them. And the first time I played for an audience after my training and all of that, I was like, oh, well, I've got to figure out a way to make this funny and, you know, and kind of commented on it, you know, like a young 20-something person would try to do. And he took me aside afterwards. He was like, absolutely not. This is the most important part of the show. We have spent the last hour and a half asking these people to come up on stage, to give their suggestions, to shout stuff out. And our job right now is to make them feel like rock stars. And after the first preview, the first time we did Every Brilliant Thing in 2017, it's not really clear in the script. Like, it's like, you might want to do this, you might whatever. The narrator may remain in the venue while people leave or whatever. So I bowed and then I left, and it felt weird to kind of hide in my dressing room while people kind of filed past. And so the next night I was like, I emailed Terry and I was like, I think I want to greet them as they leave. And I am so grateful that I did that, because every single night talking to people share their stories that I've not done a single performance where at least one person hasn't come up and said, you know, my mother, my father, my son, my daughter. And it's really humbling and very uplifting and wonderful to kind of like shake people's hand and thank them for participating, thank them for coming. It's,
I was going to say, it also goes back, I think, to the original scriptwriter's intentions, where this is, those lines are so blurred.
For
on
sure.
purpose.
That's correct.
You know, you want people to make that connection with this, as opposed to holding it, you know, depression and suicide and those difficult things that so many people suffer from or with or have, you know, been hurt by, to just kind of let people file out at the end of that seems very cruel.
Yeah, I agree. That's why it felt really weird. And there are plenty of times after a show, depending on the where I like, I want to be by myself, and I don't want to, like, I'll find a way out of the theater that doesn't, you know, I just want to put my head down and, you know, but not this. And it's always just, you know, a wonderful part of the evening for me.
One of the great things about the script, too, is that while it's dealing with this very, very difficult thing to deal with, it's also very funny and very human, very poignant. It's the word that kept coming back to me. It was just so real.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important. I don't think it works without humor. You know, it's not, you know, and it is very funny. It's hard to sort of call it a comedy exactly, but there's both laughing and crying every night, and I don't think either is possible actually without the other. But there's definitely a lot of laughter because, you know, the spontaneity of what happens keeps people sort of on the edge of their seat and kind of like engaged in a way that other plays don't. And like, it's never preaches. It's a very sort of simple human story about a guy and his mom and what they went through together.
Has there ever been a time you haven't wanted to do the show?
Also a good question. It's an interesting thing. People are like, oh, it must be exhausting. It must be really so hard. And once the show begins, it's not really. It kind of flies by. First of all, it's the running time of the whole thing is about 62 minutes. So it's a short play. But there have been times when I'm tired, it's a five-show weekend or whatever, that the beginning where I greet people and ask them to participate, that can be exhausting. And that can be, you know, and people are coming in from all different places and are like, look, I don't want to be I just want to sit down and talk with my friend and do, you know, and you're coming up and you're asking me these things and
forcing me to engage.
Well, yeah, exactly. That I kind of like at the very minimum, I come up and say, hey, how are you? Thanks for coming. I wonder if you'd do me a favor, you know. And sometimes people are just, you know, completely understandably want to be left alone. But it's my job to at least greet them and see if they want to participate or not. And I'm fine if they don't. But yeah, there's a little bit of salesmanship. There's a little bit of like, and you have to sort of like be fully engaged right from the beginning and walk up to a stranger and ask them to do something for you. And like, yeah, that can be tiring sometimes.
Yeah, I bet. But, you know, ultimately so rewarding because that's how you're building the community.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, Scott Greer, I cannot wait to see this show.
I'm happy.
And I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming in this morning. Sorry about the snow.
Oh, yeah. I left sunny Philadelphia to come up here.
Yes, exactly. But hopefully the spring weather will return while you're here. And best of luck, break a leg.
Thanks so much.
Scott Greer stars in Every Brilliant Thing, which opens tonight at the Milwaukee Rep. It runs through early May, and you can find out more information at wuwn.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Radio Chipstone delves into tramp art when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Taylor Wright Rushing is an artist, graduate student, woodworker, teacher, and storyteller. Some would say he's a jack of all trades. He's got the kind of skills a fellow could take on the road or ride the rails and scratch out a living for himself on the free and open road. Some might say he embodies the skills of the art that he says he's obsessed with, tramp art.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Rushing tells contributor Jennifer Fields about how he uses traditional carving skills passed down from itinerant workers of the Great Depression to craft his own narratives.
My work really considers the nature of accessibility in the art world. And I've really, especially going through a graduate program now, I've realized how necessary it is to make work that people can access. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. I want to be able to make work that that anyone in my family could be able to access. And through that, I've learned skills and techniques that kind of express that language of vernacular America. And I just care so desperately about not only these sort of, I don't want to call them arcane or esoteric skills, but skills that will be lost unless other people take advantage of them and use them.
So when you're talking about skills that would be lost, I'm thinking about whenever you say vernacular, I think of people who use found objects and they make the best of what they find. When you're talking about skills being lost, to which skills are you referring?
Well, I got really interested in this style of what people call tramp art. It's a label that is a little bit erroneous in terms of it's not necessarily centered around hobos or itinerant people. It was a completely worldwide phenomena that happened not only in the United States but also in Europe. And it involves sourcing found material. At that time, it was from cigar boxes that were left behind. And making what you could sculpturally out of what you had. And so much of it was done with a pocket knife, and that's exactly what I'm doing here, is everything's carved with a pocket knife. There's all sorts of unique patterns and different styles that came about over the process of making, and this was centered primarily during the Depression. To me, it speaks so directly to kind of our relationship with making nowadays and how folks don't necessarily have this obsessive relationship with their objects. And I'm at the point where I'm just completely obsessed with making these. I've been working on this style of carving, which is called chain of lightning, where you essentially alternate the chips in order to maintain this perfect kind of lightning ridge along the edge. And then I've also really worked on trying to find ways in which to build up the shape that isn't necessarily this sort of classic pyramid shape. And this is one of my favorites. And if you've seen any of the Adolf van der Ty books or any of the other sort of like hobo tramp art books, this sort of like diagonal imagery is fairly unique and really super challenging.
Would these have been things they created to sell?
Well, there's a lot of question there in terms of what might or might not be used. You know, there's all this rumor about, you know, hobos would make these things if they stayed with someone and they would give it as a gift and thanks. But you see examples of tramp art bed frames and tramp art chests of drawers and things that would never travel on the road. And those things I imagine people would make to keep for themselves, you know? I mean, it's really one of those things that I think if you have downtime or if you have something that you like to obsess over, you know, making a sort of grand tramp art box, or tramp art anything for that case, furnishings or whatever, it just makes complete sense. And it costs nothing.
So when I'm looking at something, what are some of the clues that I have so that I know it's tramp art? Because in my head, it's a very specific look and I can see it. But for those who can't see what we're talking about, what does tramp art look like?
Well, it involves a series of sort of linear chip carving. And more often than not, it's a zillion little triangles all laid out on a block and then built up over time. And each piece of material is about an eighth of an inch thick, roughly, and that would have been the thickness of a cigar box of the era. And they're built up sort of systematically in the way that they might form a pyramid shape or something of that sort. It has this wonderful quality that you just want to touch because it's so dense, not only with texture, but with these sort of little pyramid marks. And what else? I mean, a lot of the American tramp art is painted, and a lot of the examples of European tramp art have little pincushions inset in them or velvet, and often they're made out of bear cedar or mahogany.
So how do you use this style to build your narratives?
Well, you know, I've been very interested in what history has to offer and kind of what the relics of history, especially of a working class America, and what sort of things gave them a buzz, right? Because they wouldn't necessarily have beautiful gold jewelry or diamond rings or even like, you know, fine federal furniture to pass on to their children. So I think what I love so much about the nature of tramp art, and I think it also translates into my drawing practice as well, is this nature of filling in every blank and really spending time obsessing over an object. And I think it's that sort of like imbued with love thing, you know, all the love hours put into something. And when I think about that, I'm also thinking about like the way that my grandma might knit an afghan or the way you see examples of really amazing quilt work. Like these things, you know, by themselves maybe wouldn't be amazing, but then once you realize that they're this buildup of skills and years and time-based work, you see so much history imbued in these objects. And that's what I really like about the tramp art as well, because it's always flawed. I make tons of mistakes, and there's always evidence of my hand involved in the projects. I think that, especially in the modern era, you don't see a lot of bespoke things that have flaws. And I don't even like to call them flaws. I like to call them, you know, beautiful mistakes, because they're what makes the object interesting. And they're evidence of history in the objects.
And you can see in the work, there are bits and pieces that don't take away from the work. It makes me look closer. Not because I want to find more flaws, but because I want to see the process of how this is made.
To me, the mark of the hand is really something that needs to be talked about in the modern era, and especially with craftspeople. I mean, I've worked in furniture shops, and I've spent so much time kind of in the more fine woodworking world, and that's the program that I'm in here at the school. And I really think that there's so much stress on eliminating your flaws or sanding out your issues or getting the perfect French polish or the perfect finish. And as much as I think that those things are a wonderful testament to your skill and ability, I don't think they always necessarily translate to a common audience. And I think there's really something so magical about seeing a flaw in something, and then immediately your expectations have changed. And you're not necessarily worried about judging this person's level of craftsmanship or ability, and you're more concerned about what you can get out of this piece and how much you can explore. I really like to think of my pieces as a little like Where's Waldo's of little mistakes, and I love it that way.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts. This week, Jonifer spoke with Madison-based artist Taylor Wright Rushing. And that wraps up Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.